volume, she tartly describes the reputation Wallace enjoyed during her Washington sojourn. "In those days, she hardly had a smart dress in which to go about. She was little known in Washington except among the young set, where she lived as the separated wife of a poor naval officer. For 3 years, she lived in a small flat on Connecticut Avenue with a divorcee who worked in a shop to support her son. Between them, they enjoyed all the small jealousies of women, the clamoring for invitations to the most important balls and important dinners they would never reach. Wally Spencer, she was then. Small, slender, vivacious, and witty. Witty with the hard-boiled, slapstick wit which always amuses." Unsurprisingly, her cutting caricature focuses on cash, class, and background. The fact that Wallace lived with a woman who actually worked for a living, and in a shop of all places. It is all so reminiscent of Tom Buchanan's sneering dismissal of Gatsby in the climactic confrontation in the Plaza Hotel in The Great Gatsby, Mr. Nobody from Nowhere. While the 1920s are invariably defined as the jazz age, that brief cacophonous period of casual sex, cocaine, screeching trombones, drunken cocktail parties, women smoking in public, and the outrageous behavior of the bright young things, life in Washington was barely touched by this spinning social vortex. It was a place where federal bureaucrats were heavily outnumbered by the military and diplomatic corps, a fact that pleased the incoming president, Calvin Coolidge, a small government conservative who took office in 1923 after the sudden death of Warren Harding. For all the talk of jelly bean boyfriends and flapper girls, when Wallace arrived in Washington in the summer of 1921, she discovered that the nation's capital was, in fact, a quaintly provincial town dominated by a handful of old, established southern families known as the Cave Dwellers. This tight-knit group, Wallace noted with the bitterness of one frequently rejected, operated their social slide rule as they saw fit. As a separated woman, her name did not appear in the social register, the careful list of all the prominent families and diplomats in town. During her first few weeks in Washington, Wallace lived with her mother, though Wallace moved when it became clear that Alice did not approve of her daughter going out without a chaperone and returning home in the very early hours of the morning. "I was trying to make a new life, and yet every night my mother would sit up as if I was a child," she later complained. Fortunately, her friends the Nielsens were going to New York for a time, so they agreed for her to stay in their apartment until their return. It was an exhilarating period. For the first time in her life, she was living on her own, her everyday needs covered by the $225 Wynn sent each month. When the Nielsens returned in the summer of 1922, Wallace, now 26, moved in with talented portrait artist Dorothy McNamee, the daughter of Admiral William T. Swinburne, the former commander of the Pacific Fleet, while McNamee's husband, Luke, the director of the Office of Naval Intelligence, was on overseas assignment. As Dorothy, introspective and shy by nature, spent much of her time in her Georgetown studio, Wallace's circle increasingly revolved around that post-war phenomenon, single, separated, widowed, and divorced women making their way in the world. The right to vote, grudgingly passed into legislation in 1920, symbolized that newfound independence. Her desert island companion from Coronado, Mariana Sands, who was also separated from her husband, and her sister Rhoda were now living in Washington. It helped, too, that wealthy socialite Alice Vandergrift Garrett took her under her wing, loaning or giving her clothes so that she always looked stylish at the various lunches, tea dances, and white-tie dinners she was now attending. During this time, Wallace became firm friends with the sassy Ethel Noyes, whose father headed the Washington Star and whose brother Newbold was married to her cousin Lelia Barnett. They made a merry group. And while, as Courtney indicated, Wallace was never invited to the best parties, where the social register prevailed, she had the supreme advantage of being a woman in a town where eligible, well-educated bachelors were in a distinct surplus. For a time, Wallace and Ethel shared the same beau, the rumbling, bass-voiced Welsh journalist Wilmot Lewis. Not only was he the London Times correspondent in Washington, he acted as the urbane, unofficial ambassador incognito, enlivening many a reporter's copy with bon mots, known as bon mots because of his first name, and insights into the thinking of the British government. A commanding presence, he was eventually knighted for his services to the crown. At the time, Ethel, who married Lewis in 1926, quipped, "Well, it took King George to make a lady of me." Wilmot, who later boasted that he could have earned $100,000 for kissing and telling of his numerous trysts with Wallace, was the conversational star of a weekly lunch group known as the Soixante Gourmets. This was a witty and eclectic gathering of diplomats and journalists who met at the Hamilton Hotel to poke holes in foreign policy and fun at one another. The only stipulation was that each member had to bring a lady guest. Step forward, Wallace, Ethel, Mariana, and their ilk. Wallace had never been in company quite like this. At any time, one of six languages could be heard, while insider political and diplomatic gossip flowed like the wine that accompanied these leisurely affairs. The men were urbane, knowledgeable, attentive, and witty. It was at these gatherings where she met her first prince, Gelasio Caetani, the first fascist Italian ambassador to Washington. A man of impeccable manners and effortless courtesy, as befitting the descendant of two popes. This was a long way from the days of Pensacola and Coronado and the taciturn silences of Wynne. She graduated from being seduced by the sky-high glamour of the first aviators to the high-flying conversations of the diplomatic and journalist cadres. It was so exciting. An exhilarated and animated Wallace enjoying being squired around by a small army of ardent beaux. The surplus of agreeable, attractive, unattached men made the diplomatic set a green pasture for women on their own, she recalled. It also meant that she was raised up several rungs in precedence in the studiously hierarchical world of Washington society. No longer was her nose pressed so firmly against the glass. While for Wallace this period in her life was a special paradise, it was a paradise where the serpent of temptation lurked in rumble seats and sofas. Her sexual code was not to fall for light affairs of the moment, and, as she later confided, never to allow a man to journey below her intimate Mason-Dixon line. One man did cross that line, at least into the inner recesses of her heart. Even at a distance of 30 years and 2 marriages later, Wallace became lyrical and roomy-eyed as she spoke of the smoothly charismatic Latin Casanova who stole and broke her heart. Cautious to the last, she scratched no when her ghostwriter revealed the name of the man she fell for, striking through emotional passages that revealed too much of her heart. "His name is of no consequence," she averred, her coyness indicating that he was very much of consequence. She described him as suave and handsome, with jet-black hair, dark, deep-set eyes, and a rare combination of urbanity and effervescence. To talk with him was an experience. He seemed to be playing with life as he played with words, but underneath he had stern principles and a burning ambition, which was supported by broad scholarship and wide experience. He was the embodiment of the Renaissance man, a competition golfer, skillful bridge player, accomplished horseman, a connoisseur of wine, and a practiced heartbreaker. Wallace was putty in the knowing hands of the saturnine, monocle-wearing Felipe Aja Espiel, the highly regarded and hugely ambitious Argentinian counselor at the Washington Embassy. She was not the only one. From the moment Espiel, a lawyer by training, arrived in 1916 from Buenos Aires, he cut an urbane swath through Washington society. It was not an entirely smooth passage. The devout Catholic was disconcerted to find at his first hotel, the Willard, that the men's bathrooms had no doors and the men had no shame. Now safely ensconced at 1806 Corcoran Street near fashionable DuPont Circle, Espiel quickly gained a reputation among men of affairs as a serious man with a strict mission to represent his country ably and effectively. When Wallace came into his orbit, he was seen as a rising star earmarked as a future ambassador. One magazine profile would later describe him as the Mona Lisa of the Andes, a handsome Beau Brummel who orders his clothes from tailors in London's Savile Row. He could speak four languages fluently, read widely, not just American newspapers, but the Congressional Record, too, and had little time for those who were not as au courant as himself. Wallace knew she had to up her game if she wanted to earn and keep her Latin American paramour. She was in the major leagues now, and though he delighted in her wit and gaiety, she instinctively knew he wanted something more in a wife. Every day she read newspapers from cover to cover and occasionally even opened a book. Not that she read the whole work. Wallace developed a technique where she read the first couple of pages and the ending, and then picked out a relevant quote from somewhere inside the tome. In a social situation, she would use the quote as an opening conversational gambit before going on to talk with insight and intelligence about the book of the moment. It left many a dinner table partner duly impressed. Wallace used this technique for the rest of her life, always to striking effect. In Felipe's book, however, Wallace would never be the heroine of his life, merely one character among many. Though he regularly squired her to various social events and enjoyed her home cooking, Southern fried chicken was then her specialty. Unfortunately for Wallace, she was not the only girl on his arm. As his granddaughter, Courtney Hagner, recalls, "Felipe was charismatic and knew it. He was the star of many of these parties, and Wallace was just one of the girls he dated." Wallace was his Becky Sharp, witty and socially striving, good for a fun night out, but not a long-term companion or, heaven forbid, his wife. After all, she was a Protestant and still married. As Courtney Hagner observes, "He was a typical Latin man in that he wanted lovers, but also a woman who would be by his side who was ambitious, well-dressed, and from a good established family. A family fortune would also help." Wallace, though, was smitten. The woman who exulted in self-control totally lost her head and heart. Felipe, some 9 years older than Wallace, became, if not the love of her life, that would come later, her grand passion. As Wallace later confessed, "My head spun first, and then my heart. Even in my mind, there was no question I was becoming involved. The man was irresistible, and my resistance was at a dangerous low." She was prepared to do anything to keep him. Wallace, then 27, considered converting to Catholicism and moving to Buenos Aires, if needs be. She gave herself completely to Felipe in a way that she never did with Wynne. For once, the flighty, careless Montague side of her personality dominated, Wallace sharing Felipe's bed while still married. "Wallace was mad about him," recalled a friend. "She would have done anything. I have never seen a woman so in love." However, the brooding handmaidens of her passion were jealousy, possessiveness, and rage, Wallace succumbing to temper tantrums when she learned that her lover was squiring other women. The more jealous she became, the more she drove him away, her hot Latin lover cooled by the climate of reproach and argument. As Felipe's granddaughter recalls, "Wallace was very needy and bitchy, vindictive too." Felipe had his eye on the prize, and it wasn't Wallace, but rather the position of Argentinian ambassador to the United States. Before that goal, all personal considerations took second place. Though she flung herself at him, he drew away. Some 13 years later, one of his diplomatic colleagues pithily remarked, "Felipe had a higher regard for his career than Edward VIII had." Wallace should have seen the writing on the wall when he failed to invite her as his partner to the party of the year, a ball given by wealthy former diplomat and company director Lawrence Townsend and his wife at their fashionable 20th Street mansion, close to Espiel's home. When Wallace raised the subject with her lover, Espiel was nonplussed. "I cannot," he told her, "ask Mrs. Townsend to invite my mistress. Ça ne se fait pas. It is not the done thing." In a fury, Wallace flew at him and scratched his face. Within days, all of social Washington was buzzing with this story, the phrase "ça ne se fait pas" quickly becoming an oft-used social put-down. Unknown to Wallace, Espiel was quietly romancing his ideal woman in the shape of Courtney Letts, now Stillwell. They met at an intimate dinner at the British Embassy. "You look like an old friend of mine," he said. "Who?" asked Courtney. "Wallace Spencer," he said, before moving on to other topics. Courtney, who was formerly separated from her husband, Wellesley H. Stillwell, found him charming, gracious, and serious. Like Wallace and many others, she fell for him. In turn, he was enchanted by her beauty and civilized conversation, not to mention her social standing and her wealthy background. There was one big stumbling block, her Midwestern father. He was terrified that any of his daughters would ever marry a foreigner, especially a Latin. He warned her, "They make difficult husbands for American girls. They are usually unfaithful." When Espiel asked her to marry him, she was flattered, but mindful of her father's admonition, she declined. Unspoken was the fact that she wanted a man with money to support her and her children. Espiel's mid-level diplomatic position as counselor would not provide for her needs, just yet. The following morning, a box of long-stemmed American Beauty roses arrived. A little white card was nestled deep inside. "Goodbye, Chiquita. I understand your problems, but I will never forget you. With my most sincere respect and admiration, Felipe Espiel." When Wallace discovered that Espiel was two-timing her, she flew into a jealous rage and furiously stormed into his apartment. Armed with a pair of sharp scissors, she went into the bedroom wardrobe and cut all his dress trousers at the knee. Their relationship continued to limp along. Needy, jealous, and controlling, Wallace would not leave Espiel alone, every social event becoming an ordeal. Finally, he had had enough. He decided he couldn't deal with her temper and tantrums anymore. With perhaps more than a touch of Latin hyperbole, he later claimed that he escaped from her one morning by catching a boat back to Buenos Aires and sailing out of her life. They met again in Virginia 3 years later. By then, the flame of passion that fueled their affair was extinguished. Wallace and Espiel were just old friends. As he recalled of their tempestuous relationship, "She is a very dominating creature, the most dominating woman I have met in my life. She has a quick temper. She demands a great deal. When a man finds himself under the spell of a woman like that, it can take years of his life to get away. I decided I couldn't live that way any longer. I was tired of it." As he sailed south, he left behind two women whose hearts had been touched by his presence. Both independently decided to travel to Paris, the city of love and light, to seek a discreet divorce and to make a fresh start. In the fall of 1923, Wallace received a surprising letter from her cousin Corinne inviting her to travel to France for a couple of months. Corinne's husband, Captain Henry Mustin, had died in August following a long illness caused by his heroic efforts to save a fellow seaman swept overboard at sea. As she was still in her widow's weeds and was leaving her three young boys behind, Corinne's decision to travel to Europe in the midwinter may have raised a few eyebrows among her family and friends. Paris also had the benefit of being out of sight of prying eyes, a place where she could make a start in the hunt for a prospective husband. She thought Skinny would be the ideal traveling companion, and doubtless sensed that the best cure for Wallace's man-trouble was to leave Washington for a time. Wallace, still licking her wounds following her emotionally bruising love affair with Felipe, was enthusiastic, especially as she had heard that divorce in France was relatively cheap and straightforward. With only Wynne's allowance to support her, she realized that she could afford to pay for the trip only if Uncle Sol helped. During yet another uncomfortable interview in his New York apartment, this time his customary rant focused on French morality, he palmed her $500 notes to facilitate the journey. Meanwhile, Courtney, her life running on parallel lines, had an easier time. Some months later, her father, Frank, who doted on his eldest daughter, generously offered to send Courtney and her children, Homer and Louise, to Paris for a year, where she could divorce quietly, away from the publicity in the States. She took an apartment at 8 Rue Georges V near the Bois de Boulogne, hired a maid, enrolled for a correspondence course at the Sorbonne, and took art classes at the Louvre. The glorious year she spent in Paris was a cure for any continuing heartaches. It would be some months before her path once more crossed with Wallace's. For Wallace's part, Uncle Sol's largesse now made it possible for her to join her cousin on her great adventure. They booked a passage on board a former troop ship, the President Garfield, she and Corinne sharing a cabin on the rough crossing to France. Their passports are something of a curiosity. Both women, who were vouched for by diplomat Stanley Hawke of the State Department, wore hats for their official photographs. Wallace confirming that she was indeed born on June 19, 1896, contrary to various dates published after she became notorious, and gave her address as 2908 N Street, Northwest, Washington, a pretty townhouse in Georgetown. She listed her height as 5 feet 4 inches, her eyes blue, her nose straight, hair brown, chin square, and her face oval, with a mole on the right side of her cheek as the only distinguishing mark. It seems they planned a more extensive visit to Europe, besides France listing Italy and Britain as other ports of call. On January 9, 1924, they embarked, arriving in Paris a week or so later in the middle of the night without a plan or, more important, a hotel room booking. It was not a good start. They found themselves cheap lodgings, and within a couple of days, Corinne, rather conveniently, suddenly remembered a friend in Paris, a bachelor officer who had been a close friend of her husband. In short order, Commander William Imp Eberly, the assistant naval attaché to the American Embassy, had arranged to take the two castaways for dinner. With him was the tall, handsome, imposingly patrician figure of Harvard-educated Elbridge Gerry Green, a member of a prominent and radical Boston family whose grandfather advocated interest-free banking. He had been at the American Embassy for nearly 2 years, arriving from a previous posting in Sofia, Bulgaria. That dinner proved the happiest kind of beginning, Wallace recalled. We became a foursome. Green and Eberly showed the girls a good time, taking them for motor rides outside Paris at weekends and wining and dining them in town. The memory of Espiel began to fade just a little as Wallace enjoyed an uncomplicated, amusing relationship with a man 2 years her junior. That Gerry Green was away from his desk so much entertaining Wallace did little to alter his reputation as a frivolous practitioner of the art of diplomacy. Indolent was how a colleague described the lanky, bespectacled Bostonian. Wallace, rather than the embassy, benefited from his attentions. "We became quite fond of each other," Wallace recalled. As the weeks turned to months, she remained confused about her feelings, whether to obtain a divorce and pursue Gerry, or remain married to Spencer. I had not been able to make any definite plans for divorce, and yet the present status of my marriage was of a past without a future. fate now took control. When Corinne returned to America to see her family, Wallace decided to stay on in Paris, a decision made all the easier after the arrival of her boon companion Ethel Noyes, who needed to finalize her own divorce in order to marry Wilmot Lewis. Spurred to review her own situation, Wallace was shocked to discover it would cost $5,000 if she wanted to finally free herself from Wynne. While they had been separated for nearly 3 years, he had continued to write regularly, reminding her of the good times and suggesting a reconciliation. Now in command of a river patrol craft, USS Pampanga, in China, he invited her to join him in Hong Kong, where he was stationed. If she agreed, he could secure her a berth on board the USS Chaumont, which was sailing from Virginia in July at the start of a 7-week voyage. At the same time, she learned from her lover, Jerry Green, that he, too, was shortly to be transferred from Paris to Peking, Beijing, with a promotion to first secretary. Like Wallace, he would be sailing to the Orient sometime in July. As she pondered her options, she knew that if the reconciliation with her husband didn't work out, Jerry was waiting in the wings. He had even promised to pay all her travel and accommodation if she made the journey from Hong Kong to Peking. While she considered her future, her friend Ethel Noyes informed her that she was returning to America and offered to share the cost of her return trip. The fates were working overtime to send her sailing to the Far East. While she was running with the Navy hares and diplomatic hounds, what Wallace did not realize was that her romantic rival, Courtney Letts, was also hovering. Before Wallace left Paris, Courtney Letts came for tea at the small Parisian apartment Jerry shared with fellow diplomat Harold Tipman, later ambassador to Peru. In pride of place on his polished wooden table was a framed photograph of the woman Courtney now knew as Wally Spencer. "You two look alike," said Jerry, a refrain Courtney was becoming familiar with. Even with Wallace around, Green began courting Courtney, who was going through the expensive rigmarole of divorce. In her secret diary, she described her relationship with Jerry Green. "We became friends. I was in Paris divorcing. 6 months later, he asked me to marry him. He came to America, where we met again. He sailed for China for his post in Peking. I refused to follow him. He went off, I thought, sadly." It seems that Green was juggling two romances, wooing both women that spring. He may have been lazy at work, but he was a busy young man romantically. While the diplomat and the Navy wife sailed for China, Courtney headed back to her hometown of Chicago following the death of her father, Frank C. Letts, in May 1924. Here, in what subsequently proved to be an extraordinary and somehow prophetic encounter, Wallace's doppelganger, who had already enjoyed romantic liaisons with two men in Wallace's life, met her future royal husband. On the evening of October 13, 1924, Courtney found herself engrossed in conversation with the Prince of Wales, listening intently as he unburdened his soul. When they were not sharing intimate secrets, he was whisking her around the dance floor at the Saddle and Cycle Club on Chicago's fashionable Lakeshore Drive. Of all the women in the Windy City, it was Courtney who had been chosen to occupy the seat next to the son of King George V at a dinner held in his honor. Though his hostess, socialite and fashion maven Lucy Blair Lynn, sat on the other side, the prince devoted most of his attention towards Courtney, who was dressed to impress in a white Chanel chiffon gown she had bought just before leaving Paris. That a newly divorced woman was seated next to the Prince of Wales was a sign of changing social mores. Courtney, who brought a diarist's eye to her royal encounter, recalled that he had the charm of a restless, observant, appealing boy. He told me he had just turned 30 and was feeling old. She continued, "We talked and talked and talked about his life in England, about the deadly boringness of such endless ceremonials as laying cornerstones and attending services." It was a familiar refrain. His woe-is-me attitude quickly becoming his conversational shtick. He was not the first nor the last royal prince to complain about the special, excruciating boredom and predictability of the royal round. It was, though, and still is, an integral part of the job. Besides his strangely appealing charm, her main impression, even on a brief acquaintance, coincided with the concerned opinions of his courtiers, his family, and his close friends, who worried about the caliber of the character behind the smiling, effortlessly appealing public image. Astutely, she described him as an unhappy man, perplexed, of a restless nature, seeking madly for amusement, for pleasures snatched here and there between the official exigencies of his responsible state and the ever-present thought of the future, which as long as he might live he knew he could not try to escape. He even appeared to want forgetfulness in his moments of frivolity and escape. What she found the most shocking was his determination to drown his princely sorrows in alcohol, not eating a morsel of food throughout the evening. Instead, he frequently asked the two footmen standing behind his chair to refill his glass with either champagne or wine. "He dismayed and depressed me," she recalled, noting that she had never seen a man consume so much alcohol. "I cannot say truthfully that he was intoxicated. He knew better. But the spirits within him added to his strange, feverish, restless ways." While Courtney was the chosen one for the evening, she was not sufficiently engaged or starry-eyed to go beyond conversation and dancing. Others were. He did find a sexual conquest for the night, a woman who pursued him and won him in the garden. Courtney recorded the sequence of events in her private diary. "They danced most of the evening together. He ordered his train to New York delayed, and when the time came, he barely caught it. Photographers snapped him, with her, in the garden, but someone broke the photographic plate. The husband of the woman in red, who had openly bragged that afternoon that she would get him, and get him she did, appeared to be pleased. It was small wonder that others were heard to say, 'That night and for days and weeks afterwards, I always knew he had cheap taste. Imagine carrying on as he did with her.' It was indeed an amazing and undignified performance, and it is well known that he behaved in a similar manner in every American city he visited. Is it any wonder that Great Britain has not wanted its heir to the throne to return again to these shores because, so the excuse is given, of the way in which the press had treated him?" Her memory of that evening was accurate, the Chicago Tribune reporting that his train, which was due to depart from Polk Street Station at 12:30 a.m., waited for a further 3 hours before steaming into what remained of the night. The newspaper noted that the woman most favored by the prince throughout the evening was Josephine Ordway, the wife of financier Lucius P. Ordway. She was a tall and sinuous beauty with whom he danced many times. It was the start of a fascinating long-distance relationship, Lucius and Josephine keeping in contact with the prince. "Do let me know the next time you are in London," he told them before he caught his train. And they did. 2 years later, when they were in Paris on holiday, it was reported that the prince had called Josephine several times from Biarritz, the fashionable French beach resort on the west coast where he was on holiday. It was noted that the Ordways, who were visiting Britain for May and June, enjoyed a full diary in smart society circles because of her friendship with the prince. A restless prince with his eyes trained on the western horizon, a vivacious married American, a compliant husband proud of his association with the future king. A pattern was emerging. His stopover in Chicago but a dress rehearsal for a captivating and dramatic performance that would astonish the world. Chapter 4. The World's Biggest Tease. Wallace's estranged Navy husband never really stood a chance. When he stood on the quayside in Hong Kong waiting for her liner, the white-hulled Empress of Canada, to dock in Hong Kong Harbor in early September 1924, Lieutenant Commander Wynn Spencer represented the flotsam and jetsam of her past. Within a matter of weeks, he was washed overboard, Wallace sailing off to a brighter future, a convoy of suitors in her wake. In the 3 years since they had separated, Wallace was a changed woman. No longer the giddy ingenue, she had known passionate love and tasted the bitter tang of rejection, as well as the thrill of the chase and the conquest. Now 28, she was a fully paid-up woman of the world. That Wynn was tanned, clear-eyed, and charming, and assured her that he hadn't touched a drop of alcohol since she had agreed to see him again, mattered little. In her heart, her feelings towards him were stone dead. As she later confessed, "Almost from the first minute, I knew I was not going to find in China a new way of life. At least not with Wynn. He met me at the dock, and we discovered that we were as far apart as we had ever been. Actually, since each separation had left new scars and made each new start more difficult, we were farther apart. Time had taken too much of a toll on what feelings we still had left for each other, and although we did our artificial best, it was no use." In her memoir, however, she falsely describes their first 2 weeks together as an utterly satisfying second honeymoon. She was being too kind to his memory. Within 2 weeks, they were back in the old routine. He was drinking heavily, opening her mail, and accusing her of carrying on with fellow officers and local men. In a further act of degradation, he forced her to accompany him to a local sing-song house, or brothel, where he boasted he had spent some time. The consequences of her subsequent description of this visit would last a lifetime. As she recalled, to his already formidable repertory of taunts and humiliations, he now added some oriental variations. I gathered that during our long absence, he had spent a considerable amount of his time ashore in the local sing-song houses. In any event, he now insisted on my accompanying him to his favorite haunts, where he would ostentatiously make a fuss over the girls. This mutated into the legend that Wallace worked in an Oriental brothel, and under the sexual supervision of an American madam called Gracie Hale, studied the techniques that would pleasure even the most recalcitrant of men. Her skills, such as the Cleopatra clip, where it was said that she picked up a sovereign using this ancient sexual art, found their way into what became known as the China Dossier. Supposedly, the compendium of rumor and hearsay was eventually placed in front of Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin and King George V for their delectation and disapproval. Suffice to say, no such document has ever been discovered. Like so many stories of unbridled carnality that surround royal personages, it remains a deliciously unprovable urban legend. That Wallace had, by her own admission, men swarming around her, taking her out, giving her presents, and paying for her stay, does rather imply that she had not the slightest need for any training in Hong Kong sing-song houses. What remains a continuing mystery is why on earth Wallace chose to describe her involuntary visit to a place where prostitutes operated, where opium was on offer, and where gambling and drinking were the norm. For a habitually discreet woman who hid behind an impervious mask, it was a remarkably rash confession, one that came to haunt her. For all Wynn's faults, Wallace stayed in his Navy-supplied apartment in Kowloon on the Chinese mainland for 3 months. She even followed his gunship, USS Pampanga, on patrol along the Pearl River from Hong Kong to Canton, Guangzhou. Since the collapse of the Qing Imperial Dynasty in 1911, China had been in the grip of sporadic conflicts between various warlords who were backed by Russian, Japanese, and Anglo-American interests. As a reminder of the fighting, travelers would occasionally see the bloated bodies of Chinese soldiers floating down the Pearl River. While on patrol, the Pampanga's 1 6-pounder and 3 3-pound guns were constantly primed for action. Pirates were a constant threat. The gunboat's modified engine room, the heart of the ship, protected by heavy-gauge metal bars, As American ships did not allow women to sail with the crew, Wallace traveled on board a British vessel, eventually arriving at Shamian Island close by mainland Canton, a multinational domain administered by the British and French. A sign of the general unrest were the strategically placed machine gun emplacements and the rolls of barbed wire that surrounded the island. Her own defenses were raised when she discovered that Wynne was now drinking before breakfast. She came to the reluctant conclusion that she was married to an incorrigible alcoholic. Divorce was the only sensible option. She heard that in Shanghai, 1,000 miles north, there was an international court where she could obtain a cheap divorce. Left unsaid was the fact that Shanghai was 1,000 miles nearer to her paramour, Jerry Green, and the American legation in Peking. It was time to bid a final farewell to her husband. He paid for her berth on a steamer bound for Shanghai, reluctantly accepting of her decision. As he bid her a friendly adieu on the gangway, he told her, "Pensacola, Boston, Coronado, Washington, and now Hong Kong. We've come a long way only to lose what we began with." She and her traveling companion, Mary Sadler, the wife of Rear Admiral Frank H. Sadler, arrived in the jostling cosmopolitan city of Shanghai in November 1924 and promptly took rooms in the Palace Hotel in Shanghai's International Settlement. The International Settlement, comprising some 50,000 bankers, soldiers, diplomats, and others from around the world, was a self-contained town within the sprawling city. It was not a place for the unwary. In the myriad streets, white slavery, brothels, and street prostitution proliferated. According to an official census, in 1922 there were 124 registered courtesan houses and 401 courtesans. The influx of white Russians who had fled their home country following the 1917 revolution merely added to the tumult and the air of chaotic exile in a city where strikes, riots, boycotts, and radical anti-foreignism were on the rise. Even the most self-absorbed visitor could not fail to sense the ugly underbelly of violence and lawlessness lurking in the crowded city streets. It was not a place to venture out alone, especially for an American woman. In a city that was an exotic panoply of sights, sounds, and smells, the most striking and mysterious creatures of all were American women traveling without male escorts. Female emancipation during the Roaring Twenties had its limits. As historian Greg Robertson observes, "In those days, it was not done. Traveling separately from your husband was very unusual. She would have attracted attention to herself as something of a curiosity." Invested with an air of mystery and spice, Wallace very quickly realized that among the burgeoning male population she was indeed a prized acquisition. As she recalled, somewhat lasciviously, "I had now learned what to all women would be a most fascinating fact about China. The proportion of men to women, which must have been at least 20 to 1. It is no exaggeration to say that an American girl could have had an engagement every hour if she had wished. Accordingly, I decided to avail myself of such favorable odds." She had arrived in Shanghai with a letter of introduction to a man she called Robbie, probably the North London-born architect Harold Robinson. She sent him a note, and he responded with a basket of exotic fruit. For the next few weeks, he squired her around the enclave, taking her to cocktail parties, the Shanghai Race Club, and dancing at the sunken courtyard of the majestic hotel on Bubbling Well Road. Her visit coincided with the opening of various new cabaret venues, which were a welcome alternative to the stuffy, men-only Shanghai Club and sedate tea dances at the Astor House Hotel. Wallace was not slow in availing herself of these exciting new places, her escorts invariably British businessmen who, she came to realize, played as hard as they worked. Though always in demand, she discovered, too, the attentions paid her were not always honorable. As she recalled, "Men were hungry for unattached women there, and that made you think a lot how attractive it was to be alone, though all these men's intentions were not so attractive. Her own marital business had run into another financial cul-de-sac. As in Paris, divorce in Shanghai was wildly expensive, way beyond her means. Though life in Shanghai was good, very good, she needed to explore her options with Jerry Green, who was pining for her 900 miles north in the American legation in Peking. Somewhat preposterously and improbably, she stated in her memoir that she agreed to a friend's suggestion to go on a shopping trip to Peking. At first, second, and third glance, the very idea was foolhardy. At that time, two factions were duking it out for control of Chinese Peking in what became known as the Second Zhili-Fengchen War. Travel to and from the capital city was fraught with danger. Trains regularly stopped and ransacked or fired on or both. In the fall of 1924, when Wallace proposed to undertake this shopping trip, the U.S. State Department was concerned about the safety of these trains. It has been suggested, primarily by biographer Charles Higham, that the real reason why Wallace, a nervous and superstitious traveler at the best of times, embarked on such a dangerous journey was that she was a courier secretly recruited in Washington and charged with delivering highly classified documents to the American legation in Peking. Given that it took a leisurely 6 months or so for Wallace to reach Peking from Washington, this was, by any standards, a remarkably amateurish way of conducting diplomacy. This theory was first inspired by Wallace's decision to renew her passport in July 1924, only 6 months after it was first issued. Her official sponsor was Harry W. Smith, a senior figure in naval intelligence. Armed with this new special document, she now had official clearance to act as a courier for the American government. Like many stories surrounding Wallace, it is a myth. As American passport historian Craig Robertson explains, in those days, passports were regularly issued for single trips, and a special passport was usually supplied to someone associated with government business, such as a diplomat's wife or a member of a delegation. Of course, the real reason for her decision to embark on such a perilous journey had nothing to do with shopping or spying. It was men. After all, the besotted Jerry Green, described by Courtney Letts as being like clay in the hands of a woman like Wallace, had gallantly offered to pay for her expenses to come to Peking. The trip was as dangerous and nerve-wracking as predicted. First, she and her friend took a ferry to Tianjin, barely surviving a storm that threatened to capsize the ship. They were then scheduled to board a train for the perilous overland journey to Peking. Before they left, the American consul in Tianjin officially placed them on notice that the train was likely to be attacked because of the war and that they could be taken hostage. If so, they would be outside the protection of the American government. At this, Wallace's companion blanched and decided to stay put. Her husband would not have approved. Wallace took a chance. For a woman whose superstitions ranged from fear of peacock feathers and aeroplane flight to thunderstorms, it was a remarkably bold and uncharacteristic decision, inspired by the prospect of seeing Jerry Green again. On the journey, she found herself sitting opposite an overweight American who introduced himself as Eddie Mills. He worked for the Salt Gabelle, a historically important government-run commodity and taxation operation, and became, in Wallace's parlance, one of her intimate friends, a favorite among her many beaux. On the journey, his unflappable demeanor helped calm her misgivings, especially during the frequent impromptu halts when bandits swarmed through the carriages. She arrived in one piece, though she was met at the station by Colonel Lewis Little, the head of the legation guards, who gave her a personal dressing down for her folly. Once ensconced in the Grand Hotel de Peking in the legation quarter, Wallace was able to soak up the myriad sights and sounds of the Chinese capital, a walled city where the gates were closed at dusk, giving a sense of separation from the outside world. Like Shanghai, Peking was a lively international city with a large diplomatic and business community, as well as wealthy tourists, particularly Americans, who bought houses in the city to enjoy the exotic cosmopolitan society. For the first year in the city, a foreigner was called a griffin, named after races involving Mongolian ponies. Wallace duly became a griffin. The social life of Peking in the 1920s has probably never been bettered, with lavish parties, duck and goose hunting in the fall, spring race meetings held at Pao Ma Chang, or polo played on the protective legation quarter Glacis. The hub of the community was undoubtedly the Peking Club, which boasted tennis and badminton courts, a swimming pool, an ice skating rink, and two golf courses, as well as a ballroom and restaurants. Many foreigners, including Americans, flocked to China because the moral code was looser and less disapproving than in their homeland. Unlike in Prohibition America, they could eat, drink, and be merry. Add into the mix hundreds of available single men and married men on their own, and here was a ready-made recipe for sexual shenanigans and freewheeling behavior. A version of the Jazz Age with an oriental twist and a splash of soda. Typical of the carefree frivolity of Peking was Lady Bredon, the 70-year-old widow of the former Inspector General of Chinese Customs. She lived in regal style in the palace of a former Manchurian prince. One day she arrived at a reception with her arm in a sling. Solicitously, American diplomat Lewis Clark asked how she had hurt herself. Gaily, she replied, "Colonel Love swore to me that his wife was in Tianjin, but she came back unexpectedly, and I broke my arm jumping out the window." Her sexual exploits paled by comparison with the outlandish lifestyle of Constance Crowninshield Coolidge, the wife of American diplomat Ray Atherton, whose stellar career began in Peking during the early 1920s and resulted in him becoming the first American ambassador to Canada. Known by one of her many lovers, Harry Crosby, as the Queen of Peking, she was a thrill-seeker who loved gambling, sex, and horse racing. Tall, graceful, slim, and charismatic, she was an exotic and very wealthy thoroughbred raised from generations of upstanding Boston Brahmins. The writer Speed Lamkin later described this early trust fund baby as being touched by a divine fire. Others named her the lady with the golden horse with the diamond eyes. A woman with an inexhaustible appetite for new excitements, new places, and new relationships. She lived in a temple, rode cross-country on horseback, inadvertently went into battle, and was a passenger in a plane that performed one of the first loop-the-loops ever seen on mainland China. Her Chinese ponies, named Why Not and If Not, represented this approach to life. By the time she was 40, she had had at least 20 marriage proposals, several dozen lovers, and four husbands, leaving behind a trail of broken hearts, including that of English novelist H.G. Wells. During her time in Peking, she enjoyed a very public liaison with English diplomat Eric Brennan, who wrote her endless poetry and then threatened suicide when her ardor cooled. In such a tight-knit community, it was inevitable that Wallace would eventually pay homage to the Queen of Peking. Constance dates their first encounter to her time in the walled city, Constance becoming one of Wallace's closest friends, an outsized character who stayed by her side before, during, and after the abdication. They were very different personalities. Constance inquisitive, curious, and adventurous, grabbing life by the lapels. Wallace cautious and somewhat conventional. Both, though, shared the ability to command a room and captivate a dinner table. Like Constance, Wallace had her fair share of men professing undying love and devotion. Typically, her first response to the bewildering sights and sounds of Peking was not about the language, the culture, the temples, or the vibrant street scene, but the availability of men. She noted, "There are no extra women in Peking and must be 1,000 extra men. So, of course, it didn't make any difference if you had a hare lip. You were a belle in Peking. So I had a marvelous time." For her, Peking was a place where every woman was a Cinderella and midnight never struck. First on the scene was Jerry Green, who appeared with two Tibetan terriers, one for Wallace, which she named Gaga, the other for himself, which was christened Whiskey. The American First Secretary took her to dances, cocktail parties, and all the other social events in the crowded diplomatic calendar. She was quite the character. As diplomat Lynn Winterdale Franklin, the newly appointed consul for Hong Kong, described when he encountered her at a luncheon at the American legation. Just as Lynn and his wife Butler were arriving, another rickshaw pulled up behind them and out stepped a charming American girl, very simply dressed, just a little shirtwaist and skirt and holding a lovely piece of silk. She waved in acknowledgement to Lynn, who said, "Oh, how do you do, Mrs. Spencer?" After they met their host, Jerry Green, Lynn took his wife aside and whispered, "Dear, I don't want you to have anything to do with that woman." In the days when separation and divorce were not taken at all lightly, Franklin, who was raised in Virginia, took a dim view of Wallace. She was a woman with a reputation, his attitude only confirmed by his harrowing encounter in Hong Kong several weeks earlier with the man he described as "that poor fellow," Lieutenant Commander Spencer. Clearly heartbroken, Wynne had sought an interview with the new consul, during which he confessed, "I couldn't bring Wally here to stay in these dreadful little hotels. They love her in Peking. She's fun, and she's doing the embassy good, so I won't ask her to come back." Then he burst into tears before going off to drink himself into a stupor. Franklin told his wife, "It was the most pathetic thing I'd ever seen." As far as Wallace was concerned, Wynne was well out of sight and mind. She was the life and soul at that lunch, regaling the assembled throng with a story about how one of the American diplomats, presumably Green, had tried to teach her to drive, and she had managed to hit a wall. As Butler later recalled, she kept everyone laughing. She was amusing herself with more suitors than the infatuated Mr. Green. Wallace vigorously played the field, dating eligible bachelors ranging from dashing army officers to diplomats from the Norwegian and Italian embassies. A special favorite was Alberto de Zara, a handsome blonde naval attaché to the Italian embassy. Descended from a line of cavalry officers, he was a poet, linguist, and horseman who seemed, understandably, to have little enthusiasm for the role of naval attaché in a nation without a recognizable navy. Though he was eventually promoted to admiral, his true passion was horses. And he described in his memoir how one of the most frequent spectators at the Peking horse shows of 1925 was Wallace Spencer. In those days, she wore a classical hairdo which fit the beauty of her forehead and eyes, he recalled. Dazara, who never married, always carried a signed black-and-white photograph of Wallace wherever he was posted, a reflection of what his aide in China, Lieutenant Giuseppe Pigini, described as a very close relationship from which love developed into a lasting friendship. Probably through Dazara, she was introduced to the dashing and glamorous Italian aristocrat Count Galeazzo Ciano, the playboy son of a First World War hero. Although 7 years younger than she, the young diplomat became very attached to the separated American, even though their encounter was brief. Long after Wallace had returned to America, Ciano, who later became Mussolini's son-in-law and foreign minister, served for a time as Italian consul in Shanghai. In popular mythology, however, her casual relationship with Ciano morphed into an affair while she too was in Shanghai and she became pregnant. Wallace, fearful for her reputation and her prospects of ever remarrying, procured an abortion which, according to legend, was so badly mishandled that she was never able to have children. There was also, according to journalism professor Perry D. Sorensen, a mysterious unnamed Chinese official who had an affair with